This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Jump. Welcome to Community News. Thank you to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. In the next hour, we will bring you news from the Spencer New Leader and the Athol News. That will be reading from the Friday, June 19th edition of the Spencer New Leader. We will also read from editions of the Athol News. I'm Walter Bird with Audio Journal, and we begin with news from the Spencer New Leader, a publication of Stonebridge Press Newspapers, which is free by request to residents of East Brookfield, West Brookfield, North Brookfield, Brookfield, Leicester, and Spencer. Again, this is the Friday, June 19th, 2026 edition. Our first story this week is by correspondent Jason Blue. Former Yankee editor shares stories of New England. In Spencer, Mel Allen made a name for himself as the longtime editor of Yankee Magazine, a New England staple that has chronicled both the most notable and hidden stories of New England life. Through his time with the magazine, Allen has had the privilege of meeting and sharing the stories of many New Englanders whose lives and experiences define not only the American spirit, but also what it means to be from the northeast corner of the United States. Allen paid a visit to the Richard Sugden Library in Spencer as part of a library tour to promote his book, Here in New England, where he chronicles many of the stories he wrote during his career with Yankee Magazine, stories he believes help connect us all in a time of great division. Allen said, quote, "When I write about people, I spend hours, often days with them. When they see me listening intently, they will tell me stories of their lives they may not have told anyone else because few people have somebody totally listen to their story, but that's what I do. I listen, and as they tell me their story, as they open their lives, the words they speak become intimate albums that I get to keep," end quote. Allen began by discussing how working with the late Edie Clark, a contributor to Yankee Magazine, which led him to meet Steve Lewers of publishing company Earth, Sky, and Water. After Clark's passing, he and Lewers worked together on a memorial where Lewers heard Allen's stories and offered to publish a collection of his writings, feeling the world needed to read Allen's work. Those stories were the basis of Allen's presentation, where he provided brief insight into many of the individuals and local stories he had the privilege of sharing with the world. Allen said, quote, "Because of Yankee, I had the gift of knowing people and places in a way few of us can. I heard stories that break your heart, stories that restore faith in people, and stories that inspire me every time I think of the people I came to know. All of these matter, and sometimes there are stories that do all this at one time," end quote. Allen, in many ways, is a storyteller who took the responsibility of sharing other people's experiences to heart. He talked about how he felt anxiety before every meeting and interview, unsure if he could find the words to do these stories justice. However, by the end of his career, he had helped share the trials and successes of so many often overlooked members of the larger New England community, shedding a light on the diversity and perseverance of our small section of the nation. Among the many tales chronicled in Here in New England are a Maine fisherman, Joe Woods, who took his love of photography and applied it to his profession as a fisherman, capturing photos that give a unique insight into the trade. Aaron Gottiald, whose essay, The Name We Carry, details a family history of public servants, members of the military. Interviews with Grace Corrigan, the mother of the late astronauts and teacher Kristen McAuliffe. Talks with famed author Stephen King from early in his career. The final days of pioneer homesteader Scott Nearing. The weather observers on the summit of Mount Washington and Sandra Mancy, who caught a famous photo of the legendary Lake Champlain sea creature Champ, just to name a few. Through his presentation, Allen held on to one truth, that libraries, a continued source of hard copy literature and community gathering, are more important than ever. They provide a space where anyone can learn the stories of generations past and come together to share their own experiences at a time where community is more valuable than ever. Quote, "I've thought a lot about libraries since I began giving so many talks around the region and so many libraries. So many people have forgotten that happy feeling of holding a printed page in our hand. My life has been about print on a page, so I'm thankful that libraries remain the keeper of that flame. The library is ours. It belongs to us. In a country now where we feel hopelessly divided between the other, whoever the other may be, the library knows no other. Only us, and all of us belong, and that's one of the most beautiful things about a library," end quote, Allen said. For Allen, the stories he experiences as a writer represent a larger reality many people forget. These stories are a connecting thread for everyone, no matter how big or small. Stories remind us that challenges, successes, personal evolution, and personal tragedy are all part of everyone's lives. After a decades-long legacy of helping Yankee Magazine share these stories, Alan continues to work to bring awareness to the hidden tales, even in retirement, reminding us of all the bonds we share by just being here in New England. Next up, let's their voters place new faces on school committee. This is by correspondent Jason Blue. And he writes out of Leicester, Leicester held its annual town election June 9th in a quiet year where nearly every race was all but decided, even before the big day. The only competitive race was for the school committee, which featured a change of the guard as two brand new members were elected, while the committee chair lost their re-election bid. Elizabeth Zito and Elisa Heenan were both elected as new members of the committee. Zito in the main three-person race for 2 3-year seats, and Heenan is the lone candidate for a 2-year seat. Paul Messier, an incumbent on the committee, also earned a 3-year seat. Don Recants, the current chair of the school committee, was not re-elected, receiving only 184 votes to Messier's 308 and Zito's 300. All other races with candidates were essentially predetermined before the election due to a lack of competition. For example, the select board will stay exactly the same with incumbents Kevin Menard and Diana Provencher elected without contest. Sarah Underwood was elected assessor for a 3-year term, while incumbent Robert Mercer was elected to a 2-year term after filling the remaining term of David Merrow. Elizabeth Barrett was elected to the Board of Health for a 2-year term after serving to fill a vacancy. Another Board of Health seat for 3 years had no candidates, but 58 write-in votes were recorded. A winning candidate was not included in the unofficial results posted by the town. The Housing Authority race also had no candidates, but 145 write-in votes were cast with no official winner included in the town's results. Judith Zelansky and Sharon Neist were elected to the planning board with one other vacancy still remaining on that board, likely to be filled by a write-in candidate. Ingrid Hathaway and Regan Fortune were elected as library trustees, and Pamela LaFleur will continue as the town clerk after an uncontested re-election campaign. Our next story this week, Spencer Summer Concert Series, kicks off July 5th. The Spencer Parks and Recreation Commission's 2026 Summer Concert Series kicks off from 2 to 5 p.m. Sunday, July 5th at Powder Mill Park, the corner of Smithville and Meadow Roads in Spencer, with The Chain. Unique, special, different, sparkling. These are some of the words that can be used to describe The Chain, a musical group that has developed a sound that is fresh and new, yet very easy to love. Audiences respond instantly to them. Fellow musicians admire their taste and skills. Led by the dynamic presence and powerful voice of Allison McTavish, The Chain has developed a set of music that is an electric, eclectic mixture of cover songs that make the listener smile and say, I remember that one. I love it. Rich three-part harmonies, a dynamic rhythm section, great musicianship, and of course, Allison, combined to make The Chain one of the most exciting new bands in central New England. Fall The Chain next up in this series will be the DeLoreans on July 12th in what will be one of their final appearances. The concert series is proudly sponsored by Cornerstone Bank. Cornerstone was formed in 2017, born of a long history of supporting the community and providing a strong foundation to help people and businesses thrive. Serving Worcester County, Cornerstone Bank's local presence and community-based banking model enables a unique ability to deliver outstanding service with a personal touch. Lake Wickabog lights up for our nation's 250th. This is what's next this week. Out of West Brookfield, to celebrate our nation's 250th birthday, the Lake Wickabog Preservation Association, or LWPA, is sponsoring a 4th of July weekend spectacular in the theme of the Spirit of America, Light Up Lake Wickabog. Cash prizes will be earned by several, bragging rights will be claimed by many, and lots of fun will be had by all. Starting Friday, July 3rd, the weekend will include displays of patriotic and themed docks, boats, and decorated cottages. On Saturday, July 4th, at approximately 6:30 p.m., a massive boat tie-up center lake is planned to recite the Pledge of Allegiance and sing the Star-Spangled Banner. Following at 7 p.m., a full light-up Lake Wickabog parade will start at the boat club and continue cruising into the night. If you can't get out on a lake in a boat, kayak or canoe, no worries. Pack your beach chairs and picnic blankets or relax on a floaty within the town beach area. Whether an active participant or spectator, you won't want to miss it. For more details, check the LWPA Facebook page, visit lakewickabog.com, or email lwpa01585@gmail.com. Up next, Quabog Valley Amateur Radio Club taking part in ARRL Field Day. This reminder out of West Brookfield, the Quabog Valley Amateur Radio Club, or QVARC, will be participating in the 2026 ARRL Field Day, Saturday, June 27th and Sunday, June 28th, operating from 2 p.m. Saturday through 2 p.m. Sunday on the West Brookfield Town Common. The public is warmly invited to visit between 2 to 6 p.m. on Saturday and 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Sunday to explore the world of amateur radio firsthand. Field Day is the largest on-air amateur radio exercise in the United States, bringing together tens of thousands of licensed operators to demonstrate the reliability, resilience, and public service value of amateur radio. For QVARC, it's also a chance to welcome neighbors, families, students, and anyone curious about radio, electronics, or STEM activities. Visitors will be able to watch live radio contacts being made across the country and around the world, explore the equipment and antennas used for emergency and off-grid communication, and even sit behind a radio to make a contact themselves. Club members will be on hand to explain how amateur radio supports communities during storms, power outages, and public service events, and why these skills remain relevant in today's interconnected world. ARRL President Rick Roderick, also known as K5UR, recently reflected on the long tradition behind Field Day, noting that, quote, amateur radio has been part of the American story since the earliest days of wireless communication. For more than a century, the amateur radio service has advanced the nation's communications capabilities by fostering technical innovation, developing a pool of trained and skilled operators, strengthening emergency and public service communications, and promoting international goodwill, end quote. He emphasized that these contributions show why amateur radio remains, quote, a uniquely resilient and volunteer-driven national resource, end quote. QVARC, or QVARC, is proud to carry that tradition forward here in the Quabog Valley. Our members include hobbyists, engineers, emergency volunteers, and newcomers who simply enjoy learning something hands-on and practical. The club meets on the last Tuesday of each month, except for July and August, and welcomes anyone interested in getting involved or learning more about the hobby. Whether you're interested in emergency preparedness, electronics, shortwave communication, or just want to see what amateur radio is all about, Field Day is the perfect time to stop by. Everyone is welcome and no experience is required. For more information about the Quabog Valley Amateur Radio Club, visit www.qvarc.com. LaSalle University students named to Spring Dean's List. In Newton, the Spring 2026 Dean's List includes students who have completed at least 12 credits as a full-time student in that semester and have achieved a semester GPA of 3.5 or higher. Among the students named to the Dean's List were Julia Cabana of Spencer and Dylan Winkleman of Spencer. Up next, Smola supports funding for municipal road and bridge repairs. Out of Boston, the House and Senate have authorized a $300 million Chapter 90 appropriation for cities and towns to assist with municipal road and bridge repairs, with the support of State Rep. Todd Smola, a Republican of Warren, ranking member of the Ways and Means Committee. The funding was included as part of a $4.58 billion transportation bond bill enacted in both branches on June 4th. The bill is now before Governor Maura Healey for review, with a June 14th deadline of the bill to be signed into law. House Bill 5375, an act financing long-term improvements to municipal roads and bridges, allocates $200 million in Chapter 90 funding for fiscal 2027 using the program's transitional weighted formula that is based on a community's local road mileage, 58.33%, population, 20.83%, and employment levels, 20.83%. An additional $100 million will be distributed to cities and towns based solely on a community's local road mileage as a way to ensure rural communities with smaller populations receive their fair share of state funding assistance to help maintain their local transportation infrastructure. Smola said, quote, maintaining safe and reliable roads and bridges is one of the most important responsibilities we have to our residents, businesses, and visitors. Chapter 90 funding provides critical assistance to our cities and towns, helping local officials address infrastructure needs without placing the entire burden on local property taxpayers. These investments will help improve public safety, support economic development, and ensure our transportation infrastructure remains strong for the future, end quote. Established by the state legislature in 1973, the Chapter 90 program offers state funding assistance to cities and towns on a reimbursable basis to help pay for maintaining roads, bridges, and sidewalks. Smola said his district is slated to receive a total of $3,500,690 under the bill. In addition to Chapter 90 funding, House Bill 5375 includes $500 million for the Bridge and Pavement Lifecycle Asset Management Program, $200 million for transportation capital projects, $200 million for the Parkway Resilience Improvement and Safety Modernization Program, also known as PRISM, which provides accelerated deferred maintenance, modernization, and safety improvements for multimodal transportation infrastructure under the control of the Department of Conservation and Recreation, and $200 million for the implementation of rail improvements, including the design and acquisition of commuter rail locomotives. Smola noted that House Bill 5375 also reauthorizes $3 billion in funding for several transportation-related initiatives that were previously approved under the 2022 Transportation Bond Bill. This includes funding for interstate and non-interstate federal highway system projects, non-federally aided roadway and bridge projects, and the non-participating share of federally aided projects, municipal roadway pavement and surface condition improvements, and the Public Realm Improvement Program, which supports municipalities for improvements to sidewalks, streets, and parking spaces to create additional capacity for pedestrians and cyclists. The University of Hartford students named to Dean's and President's lists. Out of West Hartford, Connecticut, the University of Hartford is pleased to announce that 2,332 students have been named to the Dean's List and President's List for the spring 2026 semester. The Dean's List recognizes students achieving superior academic standing. The requirement, with some exceptions, is a grade point average of at least 3.0 and no grade below C. The President's List recognizes a select group of students reaching the highest level of academic standing. To be placed on that list, students must maintain a GPA of at least 3.75 and receive grades of C or better. Join us in congratulating Hannah Collette, Lester, Dean's List and President's List. Patrick Harrington, Lester, Dean's List and President's List. Colin Harrington, Lester, Dean's List. Grace Karbowski, Spencer, Dean's List and President's List. Casey Macaruso, Lester, Dean's List and President's List. And Janelle Sifa, Spencer, Dean's List. Up next, East Brookfield Library offers summer activities, crafts for children and families. The East Brookfield Public Library invites children and families to take part in a variety of summer activities designed to encourage creativity, learning, and fun. The library's weekly activity and play program will be held Tuesdays at 10:30 a.m. as an extension of the library's storytime program. Caregivers are required to remain with participating children, with one adult required for every two children. A series of special afternoon activities begins at 2 p.m. throughout the summer. The schedule includes paper airplane making on June 30th, cornhole on July 7th, sidewalk chalk drawing on July 14th, bubbles on July 21st, origami on July 28th, bracelet making on August 4th, and a guided tour of the library pond on August 11th. The library will also host a summer arts and crafts program that begins June 23rd. Additional sessions are scheduled for July 7th, 21st, also August 4th and 18th, with all programs starting at 11 a.m. Registration is required for the Arts and Craft program. Adult caregivers, again, must attend with children under 12, with one adult required for every two children. Some projects may continue into the following week's session. Library officials encourage families to register early and participate in the wide range of educational and recreational activities planned throughout the summer. For more information or to register, contact the East Brookfield Public Library. And this week we have Friday's Child. Richard, age 14. Richard is an engaging, energetic, and friendly boy with a great sense of humor. He enjoys playing video games, watching movies, and participating in sports. Richard has built many positive relationships with peers and adults at school and is known for being kind and respectful and easy to connect with. Those who know Richard describe him as compassionate, intuitive, and exceptionally polite. He cares deeply about others and strongly believes in standing up for people when needed while also advocating for himself. Richard's caring nature, strong values, and outgoing personality make him a joy to be around. He would benefit from a supportive and encouraging family that continue to help him grow and thrive. You can find out more at www.mareinc.org. That's www.mareinc.org. inc.org. Now, can I adopt? If you're at least 18 years old, have a stable source of income and room in your heart, you may be a perfect match to adopt a waiting child. Adoptive parents can be single, married or partnered, experienced or not, renters or homeowners, LGBTQ plus singles and couples. As an adoptive parent, you won't have to pay any fees. Adoption from foster care is completely free in Massachusetts. The process to adopt a child from foster care includes training, interviews, and home visits to determine if adoption is right for you. These steps will help match you with a child or a sibling group that your family will fit well with. To learn more about adoption from foster care, visit www.mayorinc.org. Massachusetts Adoption Resource Exchange, that's MAYOR, can give you guidance and information on the adoption process. Reach out today to find out all the ways you can help children and teens in foster care. Next up is Financial Focus. This week's column titled, Turn Your Savings into Paychecks in Retirement. Margaret had saved diligently for decades. Every paycheck, a portion went toward her retirement account. Then the day finally came. She retired. Suddenly, the hardest part wasn't the saving. It was learning to spend. If that sounds familiar, you're not alone. Many retirees find the shift from building savings to living off them emotionally difficult, even when they planned carefully. Here are five smart strategies that can help you feel more confident about what's ahead. Give yourself permission to spend conservatively. Your retirement plan likely assumes a certain annual spending amount, with increases each year to account for inflation. All else being equal, the lower those initial withdrawals, the longer your money will last. A financial advisor can help you set up portfolio withdrawals personalized to your goals and situation. Feel free to give yourself permission to spend those amounts, knowing there's intention behind them. For many retirees, the challenge isn't math, it's mindset. After years of being rewarded for saving, spending can feel like doing something wrong. It can help to reframe withdrawals as a paycheck you've already earned. For example, using your monthly distribution to cover travel, hobbies, or time with family isn't indulgent. It's the purpose of the plan you built. Connecting spending to your values can make it feel more natural and sustainable. Be sure to review your spending regularly and don't forget to set aside funds for annual expenses like taxes and insurance. Keep some cash on hand. A general rule of thumb for retirees is to keep about 12 months' worth of withdrawals in a separate account for spending and another 3 to 5 years' worth in short-term fixed income investments. This cushion can allow your stock investments time to recover from a market downturn, reducing the need to sell investments when markets are down. That said, holding too much cash carries its own risk, as your portfolio may not grow fast enough to keep pace with inflation. So while some cash is good, you'll also want to remain invested in assets with more growth potential to help your portfolio last through retirement. Review regularly. Retirement can last 25 years or more, and even the best laid plans need updating along the way. Review your financial strategy at least once a year or after any major life changes. Stay flexible. Even small adjustments to your spending can have a big impact on how long your money lasts. Retirees who hold off on spending increases in years when their portfolio declines are often able to stretch their savings further than those who increase withdrawals each year for inflation, regardless of market performance. Making the switch from saving to spending takes both careful planning and a genuine shift in mindset. A financial advisor can help you build out an effective approach to switch from saving to spending and work with you so you can fully enjoy the retirement you worked so hard to reach. Next up, it's the column by Charles, Lanterns Along Main Street. And this week's column titled, A Handshake, A Hammer, and A Few Quiet Lessons. Father's Day arrives every year with a familiar collection of neckties, coffee mugs, and backyard cookouts. Those are fine traditions, but as I get older, I find myself thinking less about the gifts and more about the men who shaped us, often without realizing they were doing it. My father was not much of a talker. That seems to be a common trait among fathers of a certain generation. They could spend an entire afternoon working beside you and say fewer than a dozen words. Yet somehow, years later, you realize they taught you more during those silent hours than many people could teach in a semester-long class. My father believed if a job was worth doing, it was worth doing correctly. He did not need a motivational poster on the wall to remind him. He simply got up every morning and went to work. As a kid, I didn't always appreciate that philosophy. In fact, I spent a fair amount of time wishing he would hurry up. Whether it was fixing a lawnmower, painting a fence, or repairing something around the house, I wanted the shortest route between broken and fixed. He wanted it done right. At the time, it seemed unnecessarily slow. Today, I catch myself doing the exact same thing. I hear his voice every time I reach for a shortcut. Measure twice. Check your work. Clean up after yourself. Leave things better than you found them. Funny how those lessons settle in when you're not paying attention. Fatherhood itself has changed quite a bit over the years. Today's dads seem more comfortable expressing emotions and spending time with their children in ways previous generations often didn't. That's a good thing. Yet many of the fundamentals remain unchanged. Children are still watching. They notice how their fathers treat their mothers. They notice whether promises are kept. They notice how a father responds when things go wrong. They notice whether he shows kindness to strangers and respect to neighbors. Most of all, they notice consistency. A father doesn't need to be perfect. No father ever has been. But children remember the man who shows up. They remember the one sitting in the bleachers on a rainy afternoon. They remember the one helping with homework after a long work day. They remember the one who drives across town when the car won't start or answers the phone at 10 p.m. because a son or daughter needs advice. The older I get, the more I appreciate those ordinary acts. My own children are adults now. One is away building her future. The other lives nearby and is creating a life of his own. Fatherhood changes as children grow. You spend years teaching them to become independent, and then one day you realize they actually listened. That can be both rewarding and a little unsettling. These days, conversations are less about curfews and homework, and more about careers, relationships, and life decisions. The role changes, but the responsibility never completely disappears. A father never stops being a father. The worries simply evolve. On Father's Day, many of us will celebrate with our families. Some will be remembering fathers who are no longer here. Others may be thinking about grandfathers, stepfathers, uncles, coaches, teachers, or neighbors who stepped into that role when it was needed. They all matter. The truth is, some of the most important fathers in a community are not necessarily related by blood. They are the men who volunteer to coach Little League, teach scout skills, mentor young people, or quietly lend a hand when someone needs guidance. Every town in Massachusetts has a few of those men. They rarely seek recognition, but their influence stretches farther than they know. This Father's Day, perhaps the best gift we can give is a little gratitude. A phone call, a visit, a handshake, a simple thank you. And if your father is still around, maybe ask him a few questions. Ask about his first job, about his childhood. Ask what worried him when he was your age. One day you'll be glad you did. The older I get, the more I understand that fathers really leave their greatest legacy in bank accounts and buildings. They leave it in habits, values, and lessons that quietly travel from one generation to the next. Sometimes all it takes is a handshake, a hammer, and a few quiet lessons. Next up this week, seniors celebrate summer at Sheriff's Annual Senior Picnic. In Shrewsbury, Sheriff Lou Evangelides, the Worcester County Sheriff's Office, and the Worcester County Reserve Deputy Sheriff's Association successfully hosted the annual Sheriff's Senior Picnic Saturday, June 6, 2026 at SAC Park in Shrewsbury. The free drive-through event welcomed 1,000 seniors from across Worcester County, providing a festive kickoff to the summer season. Seniors received barbecue box lunches, goodie bags, raffle prizes, and giveaways while enjoying music and greetings from Sheriff Evangelides, members of the Sheriff's Office, volunteers, and dozens of community partners. Evangelides said, quote, "The senior picnic continues to be one of our most anticipated community events, and this year's turnout and attendee enthusiasm were outstanding. It was a pleasure to spend time with seniors from across Worcester County, share conversations, and celebrate the many contributions they have made to our communities," end quote. Evangelides emphasized it is the dedicated group of volunteers who make this event possible year after year. The Sheriff's Office expressed its gratitude to the Worcester County Reserve Deputy Sheriff's Association and the many community sponsors and partners who support help make the event possible. The Worcester County Sheriff's Office looks forward to continuing this tradition and welcoming seniors back for next year's picnic. Well, here's a look at the weather ahead around Spencer for this week. Monday the 22nd, looks like rain showers with a high of 70 and a low of 60 degrees. Tuesday the 23rd, a high of 75 and a low of 58. Partly sunny with some rain possible. Wednesday the 24th has mostly sunny skies, a high of 80 and a low of 58 degrees. Thursday the 25th, a high of 79, a low of 61. Again, partly sunny. Rain is forecasted for Friday the 26th with a high of 75 degrees and a low of 62. More rain on Saturday the 27th with a high of 80 and a low of 61 degrees. And Sunday the 28th, a high of 82, a low of 61, and mostly sunny skies. Time now for news from the Athol Daily News. This first story is from June 19th. It's by Greg Vine for the Athol Daily News. Temporary liquor license extension won't be in effect in Athol. The select board took no action on a bill signed into law by Governor Maura Healey allowing bar and social club owners to stay open an extra hour following Tuesday's meeting. The issue was brought before the board by town manager Sean Sahalski. The special legislation, an act authorizing municipalities to opt into a temporary pilot to extend the hours of liquor licenses and to allow for public consumption in designated districts in summer 2026, unanimously passed the House and Senate and was signed into law by Healey in early June. It expired July 31st. Sahalski said, quote, "It's related to the World Cup. Some of the larger cities, Boston, Worcester, and others, have adopted this. There are two parts to it, whether you would allow your local licensees to stay open an hour beyond their license time. So if it's a 2 a.m. license, it would be 3 a.m. It also allows public consumption in a designated zone. We don't have a zone proposed for you, but we're bringing this to the board for your perusal," end quote. The town manager told the board, after confirming the information with administrative aide Bridget Armentrout, that his office had received no inquiries from any Athol establishment interested in taking advantage of the legislation. Said Sahalski, quote, "I don't know if we'll have any big World Cup parties here in Athol, but this is more informational to see if there is any interest in this or, if the interest arises, if you'd like to address it at your next meeting," end quote. In response to a question from Board Chair Bill Chiazon, Sahalski confirmed any extended hours would require a vote from the board. Currently, establishments are prohibited from serving alcohol after 1:15 a.m., according to Armentrout. Board member Russell Raymond said, quote, "The World Cup matches have already started, and nobody has reached out to the board or to Bridget about staying open later. I don't know that we necessarily need to do this," end quote. Chiazon said, quote, "My concern is that it's for the month of July. It's a new fiscal year, with the police department having a curtailment of personnel, and frankly, I'm not in favor of it," end quote. Board Vice Chair Mark Maxwell said, quote, "It's amazing to me that they can do something like this so quickly, to extend liquor hours when they can't get anything else done. I won't support this," end quote. Subsequently, no member made a motion to opt into the legislation. Chiazon said, quote, "No motion, no action," end quote. And the matter ended with no further consideration. Next up, Sam Drysdale, State House News Service, has this story. Council urges long runway to introduce new graduation standards. Massachusetts students would need to complete college preparatory coursework, pass end-of-course exams, develop post-secondary plans, and finish a capstone project or portfolio under final high school graduation standard recommendations filed Wednesday by the K-12 Graduation Council. The report marks the culmination of an 18-month process launched after voters in 2024 approved Question 2 and eliminated the MCAS graduation requirement, leaving Massachusetts without a statewide graduation standard for the first time in decades. Two graduating classes have already received diplomas without a uniform state requirement, and any replacement system may be years away as the recommendations don't propose implementation of the first proposal until the 2027-2028 school year for incoming freshmen, and still require legislative action and subsequent regulatory work. The final report, submitted by Education Secretary Stephen Zreike and Department of Elementary and Secondary Education Commissioner Pedro Martinez, largely follows preliminary recommendations unveiled in December, but adds notable changes, including formally requiring completion of the state's Mass Core College preparatory curriculum and strengthening language around the role of end-of-course assessments. Under the proposal, students would complete four major requirements, Mass Core coursework, end-of-course assessments, a My Career and Academic Plan, or MICAP, and a culminating experience in the form of either a capstone project or portfolio. The report proposes the implementation of the first Mass Core cohort entering ninth grade in 2027-2028, and the implementation of the other requirements the next school year with incoming freshmen. That means districts would have at least six more graduating classes before students could graduate in 2032 with all the uniform standards contemplated by the council, 8 years following the MCAS ballot question's passage. The recommendations are advisory and do not themselves create new graduation standards. Lawmakers would need to enact legislation before implementation can begin. After that, the Board of Elementary and Secondary Education would need to develop regulations governing the new framework. An off-schedule Board of Elementary and Secondary Education meeting is already posted for Monday ahead of the board's regular meeting Tuesday, where members may begin discussing the recommendations. The council itself served in an advisory role, but the formal recommendations come from Zreiki and Martinez to the governor and legislature. Mass Corps is intended to align high school learning with public higher education admission standards. The framework would require 4 units of English language arts, 4 units of mathematics, including algebra 2 or its equivalent, 3 units of lab-based science, 3 units of history and social science, including U.S. history and world history, 2 units of the same world language, 1 unit of arts, physical education as required by law, and 5 additional core units. The report notes that, quote, nearly 3/4 of Massachusetts high schools have local graduation requirements that meet or exceed Mass Core unit requirements for all core academic subjects, end quote. Council leaders cited research from the Annenberg Institute finding that, quote, Mass Core completion is a strong predictor of post-secondary outcomes, end quote, and that graduates who complete the curriculum are substantially more likely to enroll in and finish higher education programs. The proposal includes several built-in flexibilities. Computer science courses could substitute for certain math or science requirements. Technology and engineering courses could count towards science credits. And students in vocational programs could opt out of world language and arts requirements. Perhaps the most contentious recommendation involves state-designed end-of-course assessments, which critics say risk recreating a testing system that voters rejected when they ended the MCAS graduation mandate. The report recommends 1 state-designed exam in English language arts, 1 in mathematics, and 1 in science, while also encouraging further exploration of a history and social science assessment. The test will be designed, administered, and scored by the state and taken when students complete specific courses. Unlike the December recommendations, however, the final report explicitly states that, quote, performance of the EOC assessments will meaningfully count toward a student's academic record and path to graduation, end quote. Exactly how much those exams would matter remains an open question. The report states, quote, following additional planning and engagement of stakeholders, the council co-chairs will determine the specific role that EOCs will play in students' academic record and graduation, end quote. That language leaves unanswered whether graduation could ultimately depend on passing the exams and seems to contemplate a significant role for test performance. Supporters argue statewide assessments are necessary to ensure consistency across districts. The report reads, quote, without a uniform measurement tool, definitions of mastery and academic readiness can vary significantly across districts and schools. Our vision is that every student, regardless of zip code or background, will have the necessary preparation for what comes after graduation, end quote. The report notes that 73% of reporting Massachusetts districts already use 1 or more end-of-course exams as part of local competency determinations, and that 7 states required end-of-course assessments for graduation as of 2025. A third major component would require every student to maintain a My Career and Academic Plan, known as MyCAP, throughout high school. Under the proposal, students would complete state-defined milestones each year while developing post-secondary plans tied to college or career goals. Required milestones would include financial literacy, artificial intelligence and digital literacy, work-based learning experiences, and completion of the FAFSA, or Free Application for Federal Student Aid, or the Massachusetts Alternative Student Financial Aid Application, though families could opt out of the financial aid forms. The report states, quote, students emphasize a desire for greater post-secondary readiness support and for greater alignment between their high school experience and college and career goals, end quote. The council elevated work-based learning and AI literacy from themes discussed during public engagement into formal recommendations in the final report, saying stakeholders repeatedly emphasized their importance. Approximately 40% of Massachusetts districts currently use the MyCAP framework, according to the report. Nationally, 25 states require individualized academic and career plans, while 7 others recommend them. The final component would require students to complete a culminating experience through either a capstone project or portfolio. Capstones would involve students applying knowledge and skills to a complex question, problem, or real-world challenge, often incorporating research and formal presentations, the report states. Portfolios would consist of curated collections of student work accompanied by reflections and evidence of growth. The state would establish a common rubric, while local districts would evaluate student work. The recommendations also include optional seals of distinction that students could earn in areas such as civic engagement, work-based learning, financial literacy, and other areas identified by the state. The report repeatedly equity considerations calling for accommodations and support for students with disabilities, English language learners, newly arrived immigrant students, and other populations that may require additional assistance meeting statewide expectations. In a press release Wednesday morning from Governor Maura Healey's office, the administration spotlighted the council's recommendations for Mass Corps, but de-emphasized the end-of-course exams and the portfolio or capstone requirement, which were only mentioned in statements of support from other public officials and groups. It adds that the administration is, quote-unquote, strongly encouraging all school districts to fully meet Mass Corps for the incoming ninth grade class in the fall of 2027, and will be making $500,000 in grants available this summer to support the transition. Next up, a column by Mike Roach, Sportsman's Corner, The Loss of a Pet. Roach writes, in my lifetime, this writer has seen a significant difference in the status of animals, particularly dogs and cats. Growing up in Orange, most families seemed to have pet dogs and cats. Hunting dogs, in my scope of experience, were pets that were trained to hunt birds or rabbits, and there would commonly be a doghouse out back where the dog would spend his days. We did not have cats that I recall before my departure for college. In today's world, we encounter dogs serving as service animals in stores and other public places, and more young people have dogs and pets that live as family members. Our Irish setters would jump onto our beds and we would compete to have the dog on our bed. That usually ended up with the dog getting most of the space, but that was okay. The new status of cats and dogs has spawned a huge pet industry, which produces related products as fast as they can meet a growing demand for dog and cat stuff. It is not my place to judge, and clothing, including footwear, rain gear, goggles, and leashes and collars of every color for every occasion, are just a start. The pet industry's huge economic impact begins with food. Specialized food seemed to start with high-performance dog foods in the 1980s, when industry pioneer Purina introduced the Hi-Pro line of dog food. It was scientifically engineered to provide maximum nutrition for hunting breeds when they were working hard and needed more nutritional energy. That food business, if you follow the TV ads, now has dozens of brands that are a far cry from the same old dog chow. Fresh foods that require refrigeration are common, as are foods that cater to every possible nutritional or even medicinal need. Of course, my studies of dog food are based on my French Brittany's as hunting machines for a couple of months every year, but it seems every pet dog also has a need for a better diet to deal with a health issue, prevent a health issue, or just keep the dog as happy as possible. Cats are not my thing. Never have been a cat person. The day my sister, then Tish, now Pat, showed up at my door with a kitten was life-changing. My wife liked the cat and then added cats so they would not get lonely. All were rescue animals and they lived well. She had three she acquired in a short spell, a pair of Maine Coon sisters and a male black cat. As previously stated, I'm not a cat person, but tolerate them and the impact they have on my life. This college inspiration was the passing of that black cat. He had been dealing with kidney issues, which is apparently common among cats, and was not well, losing weight and his appetite. Over time, medication and different diets were tried, but to no avail. Finally, the time came to make a decision, and Remington, a.k.a. Remy, was put down. What struck me during this experience was the intense emotions associated with the loss of a pet. When my bird dogs reached that time, my commitment that no animal should suffer and be uncomfortable when we are responsible has always driven decisions. What we want needs to be second to what is best for the pet. Over the years, the professionals at Adams Animal Hospital have always made these very difficult times as comfortable as possible, both for the pets and the people who care for them. Their experience, understanding, and professionalism has always made a difference. What I know best is the bond between a bird dog and the hunter, and the image of a man in hunting gear walking out of the veterinarian's office carrying a collar is the saddest picture ever. The new relationships between pets and owners have become a very strong emotional bond, and sometimes the role of dogs and cats in human lives is much stronger than the family pet of years past. My world was always one where hunters and hunting dogs worked hard together, where training the dog was an effort to try to have that dog do the things that it was bred to do, and to hone instincts into consistent behavior was a goal. In my mind, the dogs have enjoyed the challenges and shared my enthusiasm and energy. There is another level where people train bird dogs hard for competition. Dogs are challenged to be exact and execute with precision. I greatly respect those trainers, like the people who train police dogs to protect and track, or detect drugs, explosives, or contraband, or those that herd and protect livestock, run rabbits, foxes, or bears, and every other special purpose. Every relationship with a dog is special and personal. Cats are different, but certainly add to the lives of those who live with them. Each relationship with a dog or cat, or dogs and cats, is special. Thankfully, there are people who have devoted their professional lives to the care of pets and the people who love them. Next, this week in the Athol Daily News, Samuel Galinas brings us this story. Holyoke, first in state to ban development of AI data centers. A proposed 20-megawatt data center along the Connecticut River has sparked weeks of opposition from residents. On Tuesday, those opponents packed city council chambers and cheered as Holyoke became the first Massachusetts community to enact a citywide ban on artificial intelligence data centers. The ban, which will prohibit any AI data center development over 12 megawatts, passed in a 9-4 vote. City Council President Tessa Murphy Romboletti joined councilors Howard Greeney, Michael Sullivan, and Linda Vacon in voting against the measure. Voting in favor were councilors Israel Rivera, Mimi Panich, Ann Thalheimer, Nicole Masonette, Richard Purcell, Juan Anderson Burgos, Meg McGrath-Smith, Jenny Rivera, and Patty Devine. The ban does not include the Massachusetts Green High Performance Computing Center on Bigelow Street. That academic research facility opened in late 2012 as a supercomputer and data storage resource for several universities, including Harvard, MIT, and Yale. According to Murphy Romboletti, the decision by the council does not need to be ratified by the state attorney general's office. While the mayor may veto the ban, she said, quote, "I have no idea if we'd get to that point, but if we do, the council can vote to override the veto," end quote. Despite the council's vote, the developer who proposed the new data center still aims to put down roots in the Paper City, which offers vacant industrial space to redevelop and access to clean, locally controlled power. Quote, "We're still taking in the council decision and want to review it carefully before we say more. We remain committed to finding a path for a project that works for Holyoke, and we're grateful for everyone who engaged in this process, the council and residents alike. We'll have more to share soon," end quote, said Ben Marshall, co-managing director with Chestnut River Power and Infrastructure. Marshall added, quote, "We believe in Holyoke, in its industrial heritage, in Holyoke Gas and Electric, and in Massachusetts as a place to build. Our interest in Holyoke isn't a passing one, and we'd welcome the chance to find an approach that works for the city and its residents. We're not closing the door, and we hope Holyoke won't either," end quote. Chestnut River had not filed permits or purchased the property at 100 Water Street, the proposed location for the data center, inside a vacant industrial complex in the flats. The site most recently housed marijuana cultivation operations. The envisioned concept involved an adaptive reuse of the former mill and would not require ground-up construction. Under the plan, the facility would be powered by Holyoke Gas and Electric under a dedicated service agreement, structured so the project would pay the full cost of the power it consumed. According to Marshall, the facility would have no impact on the energy bills of other HG&E customers. Water pollution has been a universal concern among those opposed to the data center. To cool the facility, an estimated 250,000 gallons of water would be used daily. However, Marshall stressed this is a preliminary estimate, not a final figure. He said, quote, "Holyoke Water Works has indicated the municipal system can accommodate substantial additional capacity well beyond that," end quote. The developer has highlighted community benefits that include $2 million annually in new property tax revenue for the city, construction work for local trades that would have worked on the $200 million project, and the adaptive reuse of a vacant industrial property. A hearty coalition against the development sprang up after the proposal became public, with dozens of folks showing up at previous meetings to protest at City Hall and speak during public comment periods. Concerns ranged from water pollution and strains on Holyoke's electrical supply to potential noise pollution and fears that such centers could be used as part of a fascist tactic to harvest personal data. Quote, "I grew up here. This is my home. I'm here today because I think that a lot of people are uninformed about the consequences of what a data center could bring to the city," end quote, said Ariana Ketchikov, standing outside City Hall last week with others holding a sign reading, "Ban Data Centers." Ketchikov, a robotics engineer, said residents do not have the same access to information as developers who possess the resources to shape public narratives. Meanwhile, she and others said the data center threatens not only Holyoke, but every community downstream along the Connecticut River. Quote, "I think they are taking advantage of lower income and marginalized communities, especially in a city where a lot of people's first language is not English. I think they are trying to advocate for this on the pillar of it's going to bring jobs, when in reality it's going to destroy our water sources. It's going to cause noise pollution. It's going to cause air pollution, and it's going to impact every single town south of this because of the Connecticut River," end quote. Holyoke resident Gloria Caballero, one of at least 100 people outside protesting in front of City Hall last week, agreed. Quote, what they create is pollution, contamination. We're all getting together and saying no to our data theft because it's not only what they bring, but they are getting all of our information like a supercomputer, end quote, Caballero said. Water pollution is a primary concern for 19-year-old Savannah Donnelly of Holyoke. She said, quote, I'm young and I grew up here my whole life and I don't want to see my city, which already gets a bad rep, become bad because of people that don't live here or don't have anything to do with the city of Holyoke, end quote. The majority of councils in favor of the ban, most notably Rivera and Thalheimer, have expressed they would not settle for a 2-year moratorium, which was on the table during last week's ordinance committee meeting. Thalheimer pointed to a sign that dominates this council chamber that reads, quote, makers of law, makers of history, and called upon her peers to vote on a full ban. She said, quote, we have the ability to make history, end quote. Ahead of Tuesday's vote, Murphy Romboletti posted to Facebook to clarify why she remained hesitant about a ban and what led her to ultimately vote nay on Tuesday. She wrote, quote, I have strong reservations about passing a permanent ban on any industry without a defined time frame and a commitment to doing the work necessary to develop thoughtful regulations. My position has never been that Holyoke should welcome massive data centers without restrictions. My position has always been that we should take the time to understand the issue, gather public input, and create policies that will stand the test of time, end quote. Councillor Sullivan received a resounding boo from protesters when he said during last week's ordinance committee meeting that the data center would not impact Holyoke's water supply at all, while Vacon argued the council should step back and consider more information before implementing a ban. Mayor Joshua Garcia did not respond to requests for comment following the vote, but shared his take in a June 3rd Facebook post. In it, he stated he hears and understands residents' concerns, but wanted to clarify that energy costs and the city's water supply would not be impacted by a data center. He also noted the proposed Holyoke project is fundamentally different from other developments that are arousing concern throughout the country. Quote, at just 21 megawatts, this is a small, right-sized facility comparable to the Massachusetts Green High Performance Computing Center that has operated responsibly in Holyoke since 2012, without negatively impacting our water or electric supply. It is nothing like the massive gigawatt-scale projects proposed by billionaire developers elsewhere. To put it into perspective, there are 1,000 megawatts in just 1 gigawatt. This is a fraction of that scale, end quote, he said. While Holyoke is the first city in the state to implement the ban, the town of Mansfield voted during its town meeting in May to adopt a near-total ban on large facilities. The zoning change still awaits approval from the Attorney General's office. In March, Lowell implemented a 1-year ban, making it the first community in Massachusetts to enact a data center restriction. Next up is a My Turn column by Philip Lussier. Are we focusing on the wrong enemies? Lucie writes, The Atlantic has published a story called The Men Who Don't Want Women to Vote by Helen Lewis in its June edition. I found it online. It's thought-provoking. Where to start in processing those thoughts? It was easy to reject the ideology of the right-wing figures Lewis interviews or describes. These are mostly men, like Douglas Wilson, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth's pastor, whom she quotes, saying the country would be better off if voting was done, quote, the same way we do it in our church. That is, we vote by household, end quote. This translates to a one-man, one-vote in the most literal sense, provided one is married. It is no secret that the ascendant voices on the right are those which say power to make decisions should rest only in masculine hands, and the mere arrangement of chromosomes by itself does not signify. Masculine in this case refers to a frame of mind. Toxic masculinity is one name for it. Excluded from decision-making would be anyone who doesn't agree with their violent resistance to even the most modest notions on the liberal side of our social contract, especially those associated with the women's movement. Less easy to reject was one of their talking points concerning an aspect of the mindset with which they are finding fault. I don't fully understand the need to be outraged over microaggressions and hidden triggers, and to sanitize all discourse in the name of what one of the writers calls the cult of safetyism, end quote. Perhaps my resistance to such ideas would dissolve in the wake of dialogue designed to find common ground, instead of having them imposed by fiat and enforced by scolding. Absent a mutual understanding, these kinds of coded grievances on both sides only act as shibboleths for determining who is or is not part of its respective in-group. And therein lies the heart of the problem. If I were an aspiring despot with the goal of asserting my control over a people or an outside enemy wishing to subjugate them, one of the more successful ways to accomplish that would be to encourage them to separate into warring camps. I would look for the differences between them, no matter how benign, and exaggerate the gulf between those ideas. inspire their equal vilification and the creation of caricatures of these differences, which emphasize the danger they pose to each opposing side. Then stir and let the toxic stew simmer to perfection. It's much easier to sink your teeth into a society softened in this way. Are we focusing on the wrong enemies? Why are we fighting as men versus women, middle class versus poor, rural versus urban, college-educated versus not similarly educated, immigrant versus native, dark versus light-skinned, etc.? Could this be something that is being done to us rather than by us? Perhaps it's not simply our biology or innate tendencies. Those elements can be manipulated to produce the effects we are experiencing. If we can learn the answer to these questions, we could perhaps turn down the heat under that stew. Or maybe this is just a rambling of a conspiracy theory out of the mind. The fact that this possibility occurs even to the one who is writing this testifies to the extent of the confusion and doubt with which we are all afflicted. And Philip Lucier is a retired educator who resides in Ashfield. Next up, Dominic Poli tells us about a cat saved from Orange House fire. A cat was rescued Wednesday evening from an Oaklawn Avenue structure fire that has been deemed accidental in nature. The Orange Fire Department was dispatched to 120 Oaklawn Ave at 5:23 p.m. for a report of a fire with flames showing from a second-floor window, according to a post on the department's Facebook page. The family was able to evacuate from the home. The first emergency personnel to arrive confirmed the presence of smoke, and Captain James Hopkins summoned mutual aid. Firefighters entered the structure and quelled the fire that was making its way across the ceiling of a second-floor bedroom. Though the fire damage was mostly contained to that room and its contents, there was smoke and water damage throughout the residence. The affected room is uninhabitable for now, and the family is being assisted by American Red Cross. Though the fire is considered to be accidental, an exact cause remains under investigation, according to Interim Fire Chief James Young. Greg Byrne brings us this next story. Clark Memorial YMCA to hold 30th Annual Winchendon Summer Solstice Celebration. The Wendell P. Clark Memorial YMCA will hold its 30th Annual Winchendon Summer Solstice Celebration Saturday. This is in Winchendon. The timing couldn't be better since, according to the U.S. Naval Observatory, summer will officially begin at 10:22 p.m. Saturday evening. The Clark is located at 155 Central Street in Winchendon, with most of the day's activities planned to take place on adjacent Clark Field, the site of the Wise Athletic Field. Now, the event kicked off at 9 a.m. with the Moore Real Estate 5K Fun Run Walk. Registration was $5. Quinn said for the day of registration, quote, if someone wanted to do that, I'd recommend they be here by 8:30. The race goes off right at 9 o'clock, end quote. The 5K traversed a portion of North Central Pathway as well as several local streets. A children's fun run walk will be held around midday. A parade down Central Street started at 11 a.m. and included first responders, local businesses, and organizations. The celebration ran from 11:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. Mike Quinn, the Clark's executive director, said, quote, we've held the celebration every year, except for the COVID years. The town has been able to continue the tradition, and we're proud to be a part of it. The event helps to support the programs we offer throughout the year here at the YMCA, end quote. Look at the weather forecast around Athol the coming week. Monday, June 22nd, rain in the forecast, almost 100% chance of that. A high of 73 degrees and a low of 59 degrees. The sun peeks out through the clouds and some rain on Tuesday the 23rd with a high of 75 and a low of 55. Wednesday the 24th, mostly sunny skies, very minimal chance of precipitation and a high of 80 degrees, a low of 55. We creep up to 82 degrees on Thursday the 25th with a low of 59 and again, mostly sunny skies. The rain comes back in for Friday the 26th with a high of 78 and a low of 59. And then the sun comes back out on Saturday the 27th with some clouds, a high of 79 and a low of 58. Sunday the 28th, mostly sunny skies, a high of 81 and a low of 58 degrees. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Walter Bird. Thank you for listening.
Here on Audio Journal, we read many local community newspapers each week, including the Gardner News. You can hear the Gardner News every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Stay in touch with your community by tuning in to Audio Journal. The Gardner News, every Wednesday at 6 p.m.